You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 7, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. It's a Michael Tuesday. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. Brooklyn. On today's program, Alexis Goldstein, financial reform activist, co-host of the Humorless Queers podcast, former Wall Streeter. She's going to talk about Wall Street, the LGBTQ community, in the age of Trump, Ben, and bigotry, and also how Congress and the executive branch is dismantling financial reform step by step, setting the stage for you to get ripped off and for the next great Wall Street-fueled financial crisis. And Michael Schur, political analyst for the Young Turks, going to be talking about the Republicans' brand new unveiled Obamacare replacement plan scam. Not good. Taking all of the worst of Obamacare, expanding it, while getting rid of everything that was good about Obamacare. Sounds about right. We're going to talk about the details of the plan and the politics of it, and also make fun of people. The new Muslim ban has been released, slightly revised. Iraq is off the list. The other six countries, Iran, Somalia, Yemen, Syria, still on. And the goal of cutting down refugees, still there. It's still a Muslim ban, but it has been rewritten to placate the courts somewhat. Still delusional and mean-spirited, and still fits with the racial plans of this administration. There's a fake news problem in Burundi, and that president handles it in a way that our president would certainly admire. Perhaps they're emulating each other. We'll get to that. And new revelations, possibly, involving Azerbaijan, a Trump hotel, and more never-ending drip-drip of questions around this robber baron neo-Confederate administration.
Nobody vetted this guy.
Nobody vetted him. No one knew. Speaking of not vetting, are any of the Democratic leadership vetted ever? Just planning on sitting back and watching the disaster unfold and then getting elected and implementing a mediocre agenda and then getting ready for the next cycle of Republican disasters. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Just want to talk really briefly up top about this healthcare plan. We'll get into it more in depth with Michael Schur. But gets rid of the Medicaid expansion, transfers subsidies to tax credits, gets rid of the individual mandate, but seriously penalizes people for not continuing ongoing coverage, radically scales back subsidies, and basically is what you would expect from a Republican healthcare plan. It's another wealth transfer to the top percentiles, and it's, you know, look, I guess nobody, Matt and I are fine with it. It's better for younger consumers. But here's how it could play out politically. It's very, very, very important to keep up the pressure and the resistance that people already have been doing for saving Obamacare and, of course, ultimately improving Obamacare and getting to the only sane option, which is, of course, a universal single-payer system of some form. Because this could play out potentially the same way that the 2011 negotiations between Obama and the Republicans played out, in the sense that Obama made massive concessions on serious cuts to Social Security, Medicare, went out of his way. And it's certainly a deal that John Boehner types would have taken, a Paul Ryan would have taken, but it was killed by the real fanatics in the House. So we were saved from devastating cuts in social infrastructure because of the really, truly crazy people in the Republican coalition, not just the people who are there to just do wealth transfers for the Koch brothers. So Justin Amash, radical far rightist from Michigan, he said, this is Obamacare 2.0. Rand Paul doesn't like it. Heritage Action has come out against it. If we can keep up the pressure, then at the then on the other end of the spectrum, we have four senators, Republican senators, Portman, Caputo, Murkowski, and one other name I don't have in front of me, who have raised concerns about it from a more slightly sort of centrist perspective. So we need to keep heightening those contradictions. And of course, they're going to try to move on this as quickly as possible. They spent years talking about how Obamacare was this opaque, mysterious thing that was never properly debated, even though it took over the political process almost entirely for a year, healthcare reform. They want to move the two complementary bills out of committee, go to markup, and get this passed under the radar as quickly as possible because they still recognize it's not going to be terribly popular to take away millions of people's health insurance. But there is an opportunity to ruin this, and there's still an opportunity to say to Trump, hey, you said everybody's covered. This definitely doesn't cover everybody. People are going to lose insurance. So there's a possibility here to kill it and heighten the Republican contradictions, and we'll get into more of it with Michael Schur. I do want to talk briefly about pro flowers. Have you ever forgotten an anniversary? If you're not nodding yes, you're lying, Matt, the super producer. I mean, anniversaries are hard to remember, man, even if you're not married. It's difficult. You know that people are hard to shop for. Whether it's an anniversary or a birthday, it can be very hard to find a great gift that doesn't cost a tremendous amount of money. Well, let me make it easy for you. Pro Flowers is the go-to for flowers. They're fresh, priced right, and are a perfect gift for literally anyone. And they get delivered right to the recipient, straight to the recipient's door. How easy is that? Pro Flowers bouquets are guaranteed fresh for 7 days or your money back. They have a 7-step quality check, which means the flowers are always awesome. Their website is easy to use. You can schedule your delivery ahead of time for any date you want and get back to your day. Pro Flowers is a no-brainer for a birthday, an anniversary, every occasion, or even for no occasion at all. Anytime you want to make someone feel special, they take care of all the details. Actually have a Pro Flowers recipient in mind right now, and I'm about to press send on it shortly, but it's an incredibly easy to use website, and everyone loves flowers, I actually think, and I can say this because she doesn't listen necessarily, but or this will be a test. Some are going to my mom. So we'll see whether I get a text of appreciation or radio silence. But it's an incredibly easy to use website, and I'm excited to send it to my mama. Do yourself a favor and help out our show by supporting Pro Flowers. I know you either have a birthday or anniversary coming up, so right now you can get $10 off of your purchase of $29 or more at Pro Flowers. But this deal definitely won't last long. This deal works on best-selling gifts like their 100 blooms bouquet or a dozen red roses or even their totally unique plant gifts. Just go to proflowers.com, enter code CEDER, S-E-D-E-R, at checkout to get their special offer. And while you're treating people, you might take a look at Zeal. I know that Kelly got the Zeal massage. She loved it. If you love a good massage, you don't have the time, the energy, or go to a spa, check out Zeal. because Seal lets you book five-star high-quality massages in the comfort of your own home. Kelly loved it. She still raves about her Seal massage. Jealous that I didn't get it. Just go to Seal, Z-E-E-L.com, or download Seal's app for iPhone or Android. Choose your preferred massage technique, time, location. Technique, time, and location, and Seal will send you one of their 8,000 licensed pre-screened massage therapists in your door in as little as an hour. Schedule booking and payment are all fast and easy. Even tip is included. It's no wonder that the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Good Morning America are all raving about Seal. So bring the spa to you and try Seal today. You could have the best massage of your life with Seal today. And to help you get started, Seal is offering our listeners $25 off of your first massage when you enter promo code MAJORITY at checkout. That's Zeel.com. Click promo code at checkout. Use the code MAJORITY. Right now, go to Zeel.com, access Seal via its iPhone or Android app, and enter promo code MAJORITY to get $25 off your first in-home on-demand massage. Those both sound great. We'll be right back with Alexis Goldstein on the Majority Report.
This goes out to you. This goes out to you and you and you, Biggie. You. This goes out to you. This goes out to you. This goes out to you and you. Your reign on the top was short like leprechauns as I crush so-called Willies, thugs, and rapadons. Get in that quick fast like Ramadan. It's that rap phenomenon. Don Dada, Papa, you got to call me Francis M.H. White intake like toast, tote iron. Was told in shootouts, stay low and keep firing. Keep extra clips for extra Who's next to flip on that cat with that grip on rap? The most shady, Frankie baby. Ain't no telling where I may be. May see me in D.C. at Howard Homecoming with my man Capone Dumbin. Something you should know, my steelo went from 10 G's for blow to 30 G's a show to I never seen before. So Jesus, get off the notorious before I squeeze them bust. If the beef between us, we can settle it with the chrome and metal I make it hot like a kettle get. You're delicate, you better get who sent you. You still pedals. I got more rides, the great adventure. Biggie.
Oh, you're gonna do it. Do it.
Kick in the door, wave in the 4-4. All you heard was Papa, don't hit me no more.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Alexis Goldstein. She is a senior policy analyst at Americans for Financial Reform and the co-host of the Humorless Queers podcast, which I think might be a little ironically named. Alexis,
yes.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? It's good to be here.
I'm doing well. And I actually remember, I think the first time we ever talked on this show, we made fun of... What is that show? I really don't
House
like it.
House of Cards.
Yes, we made fun of House of Cards.
You did a very good Frank Underwood impression, if I recall.
Well, I just, what I never got about that show is like, I think you could build a show around somebody being like smarter than everybody they're around, but there was just sort of this way in which it was funny that it was like, he's so transparently evil and unpleasant. And he's always just like, what about you give up your Senate seat? And everybody's like, oh, okay. Sounds like a plan.
Yeah,
I never got it.
Should resign.
Yeah,
because, like, he did something kind of embarrassing, but not really. And everyone's like, "Okay, I guess the president's resigning."
Yeah. All right. I guess that makes sense. It seems like he has my best interest at heart. I think if everybody else talked like that in the show, I would have liked it a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was. I did enjoy how campy it was, though.
It was super campy.
It was a little over the top, so.
But that's the type of thing that you talk about on the podcast, right? Like this is that you get into policy stuff, but we also get the entertainment Alexis Goldstein.
We do, yeah. The humorless thing is not literal. It's a nod at how some people, like queer women in particular, are like, oh, you guys are so serious all the time. You're so sanctimonious. And it's like this trope. And so
right.
We try to prove it wrong.
Well, it's hard when you have a culture where you have like people... You know, like Jeff Sessions, who are really funny and dynamic. I think it's hard to like get across.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to keep up with that guy. He's a laugh riot.
He really is. So I want to just start. We're gonna talk about kind of the mechanisms of how basically the Republican Congress and the White House is setting us up for a new, you know, potentially a new financial crisis, and at the very least, you getting screwed by your financial advisor. But I wanted, this is an interesting thing that you wrote back in November for Medium, and I think this might bring up some ambivalent feelings in some members of the audience. But you made the point that Wall Street, at least before Trump, was obviously, great villains of the financial crisis, but they had sort of made some moves to at least make clear that they were opposed to homophobia, that they had some understanding of kind of social progress and inclusion in the society. And that was something that you kind of took from your time there that, you know, you felt relatively positive about. And since that, we've sort of entered the Trump Bannon era, radio silence.
Yep. So I spent 7 years on Wall Street in tech, and I'm a lesbian, and I was always a part of the LGBT associations at all of the different firms.
Right.
And I think Wall Street really likes to paint itself as being inclusive and diverse. If you go to any of their websites, there's always going to be like a career section. And if you click on that career section, there's going to be a section that says diversity and inclusion. And they're going to talk about how open they are and how important it is for them to have a diverse culture and how they like to stand up for people no matter their, you know, race, ethnicity, you know, religious background, sexual orientation. And you can see that often even in their advertising. So like Wells Fargo a few years or so ago had this ad with like this these two lesbian moms who were adopting a deaf child, you know, and they really like to sort of, if people are familiar with the term pinkwashing, kind of paint themselves as, we're so gay friendly, we're so progressive. And then at the same time, they enact all these policies that are incredibly repressive to people who are economically vulnerable. And, you know, LGBT people are often some of the most economically vulnerable. So it doesn't really make sense. But I was encouraged by some moves that I thought that they were finally trying to be a little bit better about that.
Mm-hmm.
And this came up in the context, if listeners are familiar with the law in North Carolina, HB 2, mm-hmm. which was this super anti-trans bill, and Bank of America actually like spoke out against it. And Deutsche Bank actually said, we are not going to, you know, go to North Carolina. We plan to do 250 new jobs. We're not going to do it. And I was really shocked by that.
Yeah.
Because usually Wall Street, they like want to paint themselves as super progressive, but don't actually do anything. So I guess I took that as, wow, maybe they're finally changing. Maybe they're finally growing a spine. So it stands to reason that Steve Bannon, who is this white nationalist,
right,
who is against everything that you see on a Wall Street diversity and inclusion statement.
And like
maybe,
publicly,
you know,
so against it.
Absolutely,
he cites, well, I mean, this is Silicon Valley, but he cited, you know, there are too many Asian CEOs in Silicon Valley as like a prime political concern of his.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I guess I looked at this very small example from what they did to oppose the HB2 law and was like, hey, you know, I want to call on my former colleagues to grow a spine again and speak out against Steve Bannon. And I didn't really have any expectation that they would, and I don't think it'll shock anyone that they haven't. But it seemed an important thing to at least ask for, given this small amount of progress that I'd seen. But unfortunately, I think we've seen them, apart from a couple like internal emails that were reported, like after the very first Muslim ban, they've been silent, and it's been incredibly shameful. And I think it's come back to bite them. Like, I think Wall Street really thought they could have it both ways,
right?
They could get their deregulation, but still get their, you know, have their nice diversity and inclusion page. I don't know if you guys have covered it on the show, but there was a freeze right now on a certain kind of visa called an H-1B visa that Wall Street relies very, very heavily on. So in my mind, they played themselves. Right. They thought they could have it both ways. And now the Trump administration is coming for something that's actually going to impact their hiring.
So neoliberal wokeness is not working for Wall Street. I had this image of when you were talking about the ad with the lesbian couple adopting. I had this like an internal company like sort of communication about this couple, like, setting people up in accounts they didn't want, which of course happened all over Wells Fargo. It's just like, this is how we're adopting our daughter. We're supporting her by setting up people's in fraudulent accounts, which sort of gets to the essence of it. But one area where they obviously do have a lot of spine is they're relentlessly committed to overturning what I think a lot of people understand as really, I mean, not insignificant. There are important parts of Dodd-Frank. There's the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, but certainly not any type of like radical, robust financial reform at all. They're committed to overturning it pretty much entirely. And, you know, to set the stage for this, though, is that, you know, even Trump, during some of these executive orders, is talking about kind of like unleashing American business. There's this notion that Wall Street, as this kind of strategically important part of the American financial sector, needs to be restored to full profitability. All this kind of like chest-beating talk. The trouble is that even in spite of these just really supposedly brutal regulations, Wall Street banks are more profitable than they've ever been. So we start with this kind of like performative contradiction in terms of their demand and freak out, and then the reality of their financials, which is that they got off incredibly easy the last several years.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't even know that I would argue that they got off, well, I think they definitely got off easy compared to what we could have done. So, for example, like I was working at Merrill Lynch during the financial crisis, and people, and we had been bought by Bank of America, right? Because Merrill Lynch was like about to go under. And people were like gearing themselves to be nationalized.
Right.
And I think people on Wall Street thought that that was more of an option than anyone in government ever did. So, yes, compared to really probably what should have happened, aka like the, some of the banks should have been nationalized, they definitely got off easy. But there's certainly a lot of really important reforms that were put in place. And like, contrary to what the bank CEOs will tell you, like smart regulation makes things better, and it makes things better for them too, because, you know, you're sort of like forcing them to do less risky things to make sure that they don't blow themselves up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a good thing, right? I guess, unless you're someone who wants to blow yourself up and get bailed out and blow yourself up and get bailed out and blow yourself up and get bailed out.
Which,
but generally
maybe
speaking,
so.
Not,
right.
Yeah. So if all you care about is your bonus, I guess I could see how you would hate that. But for everybody else, it's a good thing to have some common sense regulations. But yeah, the banks have been thriving since Dodd-Frank, which is the big bill that was passed in the wake of the crisis. And it's not just the biggest banks. It's also community banks have been profitable, too. So what they'll do is they'll come and they'll complain to people like Trump and Congress and say, oh, these regulations are killing us and we can't move the economy forward because we're just being strangled. And it's just really not true. But it's a line that they can use when they lobby that resonates with the members of Congress, whether that's because they're lining their pockets with money and they just believe whatever they hear or it just sounds good to them. Unfortunately, they've been able to convince a lot of people with this lie.
So what are the two parts that it will take? So we know that, as an example, the Labor Department has proposed the delay in retirement. And we've talked about this before, basically ensuring that it was an Obama era measure that basically ensured that essentially, if you're giving someone financial advice, you have to be acting in their interest. That's been delayed by the Trump administration. We also saw an executive order overturning transparency in terms of companies doing energy deals overseas. That's something that Exxon had lobbied heavily against. These are executive orders. There's also going to be a congressional piece of getting rid of financial reform. So can you kind of like set the table for us in terms of what can be done just administratively at the White House, and then what are the kind of packages we're going to see moving out of Congress, and what would it look like? Is it just sort of like pre-Dodd-Frank, or are we going to like pre-Dodd-Frank? Like, while they have it on the table, is there even more they can do to strip away regulation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I guess let me just hit on two of the things that you mentioned, because unfortunately for all of us, there are many ways they can attack financial reform. So one of them is administratively, right? Trump's executive orders another thing I would put in that category is just the people that he has put into his cabinet can take action.
Uh-huh.
So that is the what you referred to just now, the what I call the conflict of interest rule, that says that you're, you know, the person advising you on your retirement savings, Obama said they should act in your best interest, which makes sense. The Department of Labor has used their sort of administrative authority to put a delay on that rule. And right now, actually, you can, there are, we have about, I think, 10 days left. They have to ask the public for comment about this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will tweet this out as soon as I get off with you, a link to a petition where we have, where you can actually weigh in that comment period and let them know you think it's a terrible idea to delay it. Just to make it a little more real, this Obama administration rule basically said that we were losing $17 billion a year because of conflicted retirement advice. And at an individual level, people were basically losing about 1% in savings and in profits that they would have gotten if their advisor was giving them good advice that wasn't conflicted. And the way that those conflicts manifest is, like, let's say you work at Morgan Stanley as a, you know, retirement advisor. You might be incentivized to pitch a particular product. And if you sign enough people up for this one product, they might give you a watch or, like, a trip on a cruise or just straight up give you more money. And so they're going to pitch you the product that pays them more instead of the product that costs you less.
Would you say it's analogous to the problem in the healthcare industry of, like, pharma reps, you know, enticing doctors to promote pills? Like, hey,
that's a great analogy. Absolutely. Yeah. And you can think about, like, they tried to take some steps to address that. And like, they used to be able to give doctors all kinds of freebies. And
right.
I know this because my dad was a physician, and we would come home with, like, Zen water fountains branded with, like, Prozac on the side and, like, all these, like, random gifts.
I can see where you developed your unique sense of humor from.
Yeah. So that's one way they can attack it, regulations. Another way they can attack it is through Congress. And believe it or not, going way back to when Newt Gingrich was still in Congress, mm-hmm. as a part of the contract with America, they created this horrible new thing called the Congressional Review Act that basically says any new regulation, Congress has about 60 days to decide whether or not they want to undo that regulation. So all of these Obama regulations that were, like, finalized right before the election or right before the end of his term are now sort of open for Congress to decide whether or not they want to undo them.
Mm-hmm.
And that one that you mentioned that required that people disclose some level of transparency about, like, the bribes, essentially, right? Like,
yeah.
Exxon being able to, like,
yes.
bribe people internationally in order to get deals done. That was an Obama-era regulation that they used this procedure called the Congressional Review Act to undo. And there are a bunch of other regulations that people are really worried that the Republicans in Congress, and perhaps some Democrats may go along with it, going to undo, everything from environmental regulations to financial regulations to anything you can imagine. I believe the Coldstream one was also undone using that process. So that's a second way they can attack things. And the third way they can attack things is just by not enforcing the law.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you guys covered Ben Carson's speech on the show or planned.
Well, I would recommend that you stay tuned after you're over, and you will certainly hear. I'll probably be talking like Ben Carson pretty much the entire second half of the show.
Well,
yes.
I feel like I should just not do work for the rest of the day and just listen to that. Sounds amazing. But anyway, so I think one could imagine that maybe Ben Carson would not enforce certain laws that the Department of Housing and Urban Development is committed to.
DeFaro was the first person that enforced housing discrimination. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm jumping
right?
the gun. Yeah,
but
go ahead.
He's not the only example. Like, just imagine a regulator. Right, the head of the EPA is now an anti-environmental, like pro-climate change person. Like, one could imagine that even if he doesn't undo the regulations, he could just direct people not to enforce them.
Well, isn't that stunning?
So that's sort of the third thing.
Isn't that stunning, Alexis, though, that, like, those are, and I just want to kind of get your broad thoughts on that, because what's weird about that is that there are two kinds of picks, it seems like, though. Like, you have Ben Carson, Betsy DeVos, let's destroy these departments through like this kind of fusion of rabid ideology, non-enforcement, and incompetence. But then people like Pruitt and people like Mnuchin and people like Wilbur Ross, environment, finance positions, I would say that those are people who are quite, like, I think Pruitt is an EPA expert. I think he knows the agency very well and is quite savvy on this stuff and completely committed to undermining it and destroying it. And it seems like you see the same pattern when it comes to Treasury and Commerce and other areas overseeing the financial regulation.
Yeah, I mean, and even DeVos, who I think doesn't know much about education, has been hiring people that do know how to attack important rules. So, for example, she just hired someone named Taylor Hansen, who used to be a lobbyist for for-profit colleges who have been in a crisis up until the Trump administration because they were scamming students and getting sued for it and going bankrupt. And she just hired a former lobbyist for those colleges. So that's a very bad sign. So even if she doesn't really know much about that area, she's hired someone who's going to do I'm worried it's going to do very bad things.
She knows how to staff up. So the last question I have to ask you, and this is always the sort of, this avalanche of terrible things, but where are the openings? What can be done? I think on healthcare as an example, ironically, this is another area as far as the Republican replacement of Obamacare, where there's actually the sort of the real extremists might end up killing the replacement bill because it doesn't go far enough. Is there any points with regards to overturning financial reform where there's any openings in the Republican coalition, or is this pretty much they're all on board to get rid of it? And, you know, what can we do?
I do think that there are pockets where people want things that are more extreme than they could feasibly get. But I think that, for me, the biggest point of leverage and pressure is asking questions in town halls and recording them, because I think that's where we're seeing movement in healthcare. And I think, you know, not wanting a future financial crisis is a pretty universal bipartisan thing. And I think most of the time, Congress feels like they can get away with getting rid of these rules that protect our economy because they think people don't know about it or don't care about it or are bored by it.
Right.
And so I think our biggest point of leverage, and I saw some of them, like I was watching Rachel Maddow like 2 weeks ago and somebody asked a question about Dodd-Frank. He was like, look, I was really hurt by the 2008 crisis. I don't want another one. And he asked Senator Grassley, like, are you going to protect the Consumer Bureau? And Grassley was kind of like, well, we won't destroy it, but we might defund it. And it was a terrible answer. But this is something that's very bipartisan. It's popular with Republicans and Democrats, right? Most people don't want to lose a bunch of money in a future crisis.
Yeah.
I don't think you see as much of that split that you're talking about with healthcare, but it definitely does exist. And I should just shout out, there is one Republican in the House who often votes with the Democrats to protect financial reform. He's a guy named Walter Jones. He's also
guy from North Carolina.
Yeah, and he's also the guy calling for an independent investigation, so it's not totally unheard of. But yeah, if you're in a red state, I would encourage you to pressure your representative as hard as you can. Maybe we can get another Walter Jones out there. He's not great on a lot of things, but he's pretty good at financial reform.
Yeah, he also had some reaction to the invasion of Iraq. He's an unusual guy, but he's still
a wide range of opinions.
Yes. I don't think he would be a fan of the Humorless Queers podcast.
No,
that would be part of the negative part of his opinions.
He's definitely got some bad opinions.
Yeah. Alexis Goldstein, I thank you so much for joining us. Humorless Queers podcast, Americans for Financial Reform. I appreciate all the work you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, everyone. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Michael Shore. We're talking Obamacare.
Listen to Mojo, an archangel.
No rest of
oh, yes.
Call the Father's name, it's the same what they want.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Michael Schur of the Young Turks. He's former chief political correspondent for Al Jazeera America. Merhaba, Michael.
Yeah, I was based there, right? What is that? Was that a word that I was supposed to know?
Yeah, it's just Arabic for hi.
Yeah, well, I'm just pretending that I don't know it.
I know.
Because that was a different life, a different assignment. How are you?
A different life and a different assignment. I like it.
A network that doesn't exist anymore.
A network that was so crazy because I was on there a couple of times and it was this major, like, I mean, I know you obviously know it infinitely better than me, but it was like this real thing. It was like this massive operation with all of these people and all this stuff. And then it was just like, all right, that's a wrap.
Yep. It couldn't have been more real. More money could not have been spent. More professional people could not have been there. They should have changed the name. Because I think the perception, for obvious reasons, was that Americans were going to watch that network, that people weren't going to come on with us. I mean, we got you, but that wasn't, you know, in fairness, a
wasn't,
great get.
Wasn't, ooh, coming out swinging.
You know, for a guy that
can't even handle an interview with a couple of like Boston shock jocks and convince them that he knows what he's talking about.
True,
that's like a pretty, like you're getting really cocky there.
But you know, I went in on the defensive that time. So I figured if I start now.
Yeah. You got to come out swinging.
Know, it's tactically different. Yeah. But no, in point of fact, there was great journalism. There were great journalists there. It was fair. They were telling stories that you cannot find now.
Great guest analysts, as an example.
Yeah.
That was something that they did an incredible job on, finding the right
with
guests.
With guest analysts, yeah.
Yes, they were. That was something they were really exceptional on.
It was, people thought when it shut down, it was because of the price of oil or a couple of the guest analysts that they had picked kind of taking the network down. I really think it was the price of oil dropping.
Yeah, no. And then some people said that it was like luring Jewish guys from TYT to cover politics for them. But I think it was more of the price of oil.
I think it was probably the price of oil.
Yeah, I'll go with price of oil. Actually, I think the last thing about this, though, that in all sincerity, I think the really big problem was that the agreement they signed on their internet distribution. Because, whole reason that there was an opening for Al Jazeera was because if you were interested, not just in the Middle East, but really in sophisticated coverage of anywhere in the quote-unquote South, and a place that was global but had a center of gravity that was a little bit more, you know, in obviously Qatar or Abu Dhabi than just, you know, London or Washington or New York, you stream that and you watched it, and the coverage was incredible. So they built the kind of like a very – you know, a sophisticated younger internet audience. And then they just went to like the recesses of cable. And, you know, it could even just speak personally. I liked them, but I wasn't going to hunt for it, you know, or even have my TV on.
No,
it just wasn't the right strategy.
Like a lot of people. I mean, they forfeited something major. And in order to get cable carriage, they had to do that. So their cable deals, and this isn't fact, but this is presumed, is that they were paying to be on some of these carriers.
Right.
These carriers were not going to let them go online with this content if they were also going to be on cable because of the, you know, I would say that they were caustic to a lot of people just coming in, just by name, just by, you know, history. The Al Jazeera Arabic channel was problematic for some people because there's three different channels, English, Arabic, and then there was America.
Right.
So you're right, though. I mean, once you lose that audience, you have cultivated and nurtured with really good journalism, and it's gone and inaccessible. That's a problem. And, you know, you're only carried, you know, it was very hard to find Al Jazeera.
All right, but enough whining about it, Michael. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. So today, last night, you're the perfect person to be, because we had booked this before, but I'm very glad that we're talking after this release of the Obamacare replacement plan.
Right.
So there's two parts to tease out about this. There's the policy and the politics, obviously, but let's just sort of cover the policy a bit. I mean, basically,
yeah,
the main features that I see are, you know, I think, I mean, obviously from a delivery perspective, this accentuates all of the worst parts of Obamacare and it scraps the best parts of Obamacare. And it also, you know, positions a place where Obamacare, for all of its flaws, worked in very specific ways. There's an infrastructure to it, which isn't necessarily in place with this bill. But we're getting rid of subsidies, replacing them with tax credits. The subsidies or the tax right. credits are going to be far less generous. The taxes on corporations, upper-end individuals, and also like tanning salons, as an example, and other products like that, they're going to go away, right? right? Because they apparently, even though Boehner isn't there anymore, his old friends still want to look out for him. Then we're going right. to get rid of, and this is important, the Medicaid is going to get cut by taking it from essentially just a program that, with federal money, says, look, if you meet that threshold, you get Medicaid, period, because you need it. We're going to go to a block grant system, which just says to a state, this is your Medicaid money, no more, no less. If there's a massive economic catastrophe and 10,000 people lose health care, doesn't matter. Or, you know, or it can matter, but you have to figure it out on your own. So this is the basic mechanics of it, and I just seems to me on a policy level that they have been spooked enough by the town hall meetings that they are not saying just coming out with like a, you know, what people like Rand Paul would like, which would be like just a paragraph long bill saying we're getting rid of all of this and read a Ayn Rand book and, you know, take a run. Right. But at the same time, stealthily and slowly, millions of people are going to lose their health insurance, and I guess they're positioning it where this is somehow still the fault of Obamacare, not what they're literally proposing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's probably true, and that gets into the politics of it. You know, when you talk about the fault and who does it, policy, I think you summarized it pretty perfectly. I think that the things that it does hang on to, the one thing you didn't talk about was, and I think it's one of the most important parts of why this is failed legislation, is the expansion, you know, the Medicare expansion. And I think that when you look at what that, I think I said Medicare, I meant to say Medicaid, but
yeah, gotcha.
The when you look at that, that expansion and the fact that 31 states have it, Kansas and Maine are on the cusp of putting it in, and they may even rush it now. And there are states with Republican governors that are loath to see this change. You run into a part of the policy that works. I mean, I think it's not just about the policy that doesn't work, but the policy that does work. And you have Republican governors who are saying, whoa, don't touch this because this is working in my state. And I think that's why there's a little bit of DOA here. It doesn't behoove anyone to embrace it on policy if on politics it doesn't work. And I think that's what Republicans are going to run into. But with all, you know, some of the sweeteners, I think a lot of what made Obamacare work was the way that the story was told. The pre-existing conditions argument was something that was very difficult for anyone to argue against except the insurance companies, and even their acolytes in Congress had a hard time going, you know, against that. It preserves that in a sense, but then when you look at the policy, it's not really preserved, because if you are between jobs and you choose not to get coverage, when you come back in, even if you have that pre-existing condition, you're paying that 30% premium. And that's going to hurt you more because you're going to need it sooner
Explain that, Michael. That's really important. I neglected to mention that part. So now, instead of the individual penalty, which is the, you know, if you choose to not get health care, we're going to ding you in your tax bill. That's getting scrapped, idea. Right? That's we're getting right. rid of that. But what they can do now is hit you really hard for not having continuous coverage. Explain that.
Yeah, exactly. So let's say you leave your job and you say, well, you know, I'm feeling pretty well. There's nothing catastrophic happening. There's nothing even mild happening. I'm going to wait until I get a new job. I don't get a new job, and it's, you know, it's been 14 months, and you know what, I broke my shoulder, and now I have to, you know, I need some coverage.
There's
right?
not another oil sheik starting a new major network. What am I
right.
going to do?
Not yet. Not yet.
Yeah, there
it's
you
still
go.
Early. Price, you know, yeah. price hasn't climbed yet.
Nope.
And so you're out of work, and you want, but you do need some coverage. Well, you are paying a 30% premium on your first year's premium, which is a lot of money for a lot of people,
right.
and especially people with pre-existing conditions. So it's they're the ones that are going to need it more and be hit the hardest. And it's only for 1 year, but that fluctuates. I mean, what that rate is not set, and that's that puts people at a terrible disadvantage. And that's one of the, I would say, the hallmarks of this bill is that it does that. So they're not paying insurance. The insurance isn't being paid on people who choose not to go in. There's not even a tax bump to it. But if you want to join the market again, which you can do at any time, it's 30% more. And that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. So then let's get to the politics of it. I sort
yeah.
of posited in the opening of the show, I think that this is still very tricky for them. And it should be said, you know, first and foremost, people need to redouble their efforts to go to those town halls. That footage, we played it when I was hosting last week, of this older gentleman in Iowa saying to Chuck Grassley, like, you were the death panel guy. Well, I'd ask you to not vote to create the largest death panel in the country by repealing Obamacare. You know, I mean, this is very effective stuff. And also, incidentally.
Yeah, that was some really great rhetoric.
And true. I mean, you know, really yeah. best of all worlds, like pungent, earthy, and correct. Now, I think that so there's the pressure.
I thought you were describing a Pinot Noir.
Yeah, pungent, earthy, and correct.
Yeah.
So, but I think that, like, okay, so you keep up the pressure on Republicans at these town hall meetings. And then you have, I think, an analogous situation to 2011 when those awful grand, at least, I guess, you know, from my left perspective, these ridiculous grand bargain negotiations were taking place. And Obama offered some stuff that, to me, is just truly inexcusable on Social Security and Medicare. What saved us from cuts to those programs was the fanaticism of this new class of Republican Congress people, which have, you know, of course, only gotten crazier and crazier and more extreme even from that time. So when you look at Justin Amash saying this is Obamacare 2.0, Heritage Action says this doesn't go far enough. You know, this is just Trump care. We need to get rid of it. It seems like, I mean, maybe that contradiction inside the Republican base could get split between, you know, a handful of people that are like, wait a second, I'm a radical conservative, but I don't know, Medicaid expansion is working in my state. I don't want to get heat for that. Then you got the Paul Ryan kind of fat cats in the middle, and then you still have your, you know, read Ayn Rand and take a jog people. Maybe that's not enough. Maybe you could push it out of the House, but it seems like you're going to die in the Senate.
Yeah, I think it's going to die in the House, frankly.
Oh, wow.
I think that, I think when you hear these, you know, the Freedom Caucus people, the extreme conservative right-wing people, you heard Dave Brat, congressman from Virginia yesterday, saying this is ridiculous. How can we do this? We have a shot at this, and this is not the shot we should be taking, essentially.
Yep, he's the guy who took out Eric Cantor.
He is,
right,
yeah.
Okay.
And I have to say, he's a smart guy. Mm-hmm. He's a compelling guy. He's somebody who looks at this stuff, and, you know, I probably don't agree with him on very much at all. But he's smart. And I think that when you hear the broken coalition that they have, I mean, this is forgetting, you know, putting 2016 aside, going into that election, everybody thought, well, the Republican Party's in disarray because nobody gets along. You have a speaker that some people kind of acquiesce to but never really proffered. You have these extreme conservatives. You have the sort of older, established, and not establishment, but people who have been in the leadership there for a while. You have the Southern Coalition. And that's a broken coalition because they're all at odds. And it, when 17 people run for president from your party, that tells you something.
Mm-hmm.
And then they end up with this guy. So So these are all the problems we knew the Republicans had before Donald Trump, and they're coming out in this legislation. It's very easy to explain away the devil you know when you are running for Congress. But if you come back and you say to your constituents, hey, I didn't vote for this because this was Obamacare light, and you start using those words, your voters will sympathize with you. They'll thank you for not voting for something that really was no different than what they want to get rid of, or they think they want to get rid of. Why they think that is their own ridiculous problem, because it's helping most of those people, most of those Trump voters.
But actually, ironically, maybe not with these changes. I mean, what's funny about it is that this, like, and I don't want to let Obamacare entirely off the hook, because I do think that, you know, it certainly would have worked. It would have, I mean, the politics aside, policy-wise, it would work significantly more effectively with a public option. But what they're proposing now would bring all of the problems that they said Obamacare had to a way bigger extent, because you would all of a sudden be like, okay, well, you know, you're 60 years old and you make, you know, 20 grand and you're in a rural state. Under Obamacare, you might have access to a very good subsidy. That's gone now.
I do think, I mean, forgetting the problems of Obamacare for a second, because you have to for the politics of this. I mean, if you are dissecting why this is going to fail, it has nothing to do with the details of what did and didn't work about Obamacare. I agree with you. I think that, you know, I think that medical care and health care should be a birthright in this country. And I think that the public option is important and all of that. But I also, you know, I feel like I'm pretty practical about the reality of politics that you're never going to get everything you want at the beginning, and these were great strides. But that said, I totally, agree with what you're saying, that if they see this as they do, and they want to dismantle something that is helping people, even despite its imperfections, that's a losing gambit. And I think a lot of these Republicans see that too.
So then let's get into the Trump equation. Now, obviously, he doesn't have any idea what he's talking about, and he is
he doesn't understand that.
Yeah, he doesn't understand, and I think it's clear. You know, we were joking, like, he could just throw a dart. I mean, if the last person he talked to about healthcare before he made a decision was Bernie Sanders, I mean, look, we need to have national healthcare. Like, he's all over the map. But I do think that healthcare is an area where, because of how high profile it is, and because of, for whatever reason, he has said so vociferously on so many occasions that everyone needs to be covered, there needs to be a national system. And I think if you're a Trump voter, frankly, and, you know, again, setting aside judgments about what you should have made the calculation, but if you were watching him during the campaign and you were actually trusting what he was saying, which is beyond me, it's completely understandable that you could actually think, oh, this guy's just campaigning on making Obamacare cheaper, because he said everyone needs to have health care and I'm going to replace Obamacare with something better. It sounds great. So, again, he'll sign whatever's put in front of him. He doesn't care. He doesn't know the details. He's persuadable. And obviously, you know, he's completely incompetent at his job, to say the least. But I do think that this is an area that if you started getting a lot of people tweeting at him, and his sense that between him and his base and his sense of his popularity, that this bill isn't going to cut it, that could be the whole next thing that throws the whole thing into disarray when he tweets like, I don't really like what Paul put together. Sorry.
Well, I mean, here's the other thing you have to remember. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're 100% right. This is the guy. I mean, he has no real concept about what he wants other than he wants to dismantle Obama-like things. And I think that he still has a chip on his shoulder from Obama making fun of him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
I would say so.
I think, you know, yeah. So I think it goes back to those kind of, you know, petty things. But I do, you know, look, he has Tom Price for a reason in his cabinet, because Tom Price was somebody who worked well with Paul Ryan, and they were kind of on the same budget and health committees. So it for him to look at the Congress and say, I need the Congress, put this faith in Paul Ryan to do this, you can be really sure that he's going to go after Paul Ryan when this doesn't work, when they had a failed thing. If they just listened to Trump, if they just listened to me, if I had been able to write this. But no, you know, Paul Ryan's a loser, sad. You know, that's what you can forecast.
Because, and that's actually Trump at his best. He's the most talent he has is owning Republicans, ironically.
Yeah, that's a good point, you know. And I think, though, that he's going to have a hard time owning them as a majority in the House, you know, if he is not able to at least let the Congress go in the direction that they want to go. And, you know, for all these conservatives and all these Club for Growth people, the Club for Growth came out today and opposed this legislation. So I just don't see how it's going to go anywhere. I think it's going to be a monumental failure. After all this time, it seemed like it was rushed. I also don't know how many of these people were able to read it so quickly. But it was rushed. It was put through. And if it fails, the president is much better having Paul Ryan own its failure than having him, you know, having the White House own it. That said, the Republicans, in order to keep it together in their majority, are going to have to vote it down, because they're not going to be able to go back with this kind of legislation and take it to their voters, especially the ones obviously in closer districts.
And then the window on this is not terribly long, because before we know it, like, we're going into midterms here, and you know, it's the map is terrible for Democrats, but at the same time, like, this is obviously a really different situation. And you know, do you all of a sudden want to be heading into midterms and just, you know, I mean, even Democrats, as totally incompetent as they are, I think should be able to know how to use an ad with a scumbag like Jason Chaffetz saying, like, well, if you want your kid to have heart medicine, stop having an iPhone. I mean, I think anybody could put those ads together, even Democrats.
Right. They probably could. They would probably overestimate the number of people who know who Jason Chaffetz is. But I do think that, I mean, that's what this is all about. It's about the midterms. And I don't think the map is any worse for the Democrats in the House than it might ever be. As a matter of fact, I think that there's a tenuous Republican hold, which is why so many of these Republicans are going to vote against this legislation, because it's so much. I mean, it's what I was saying at the top, if you were listening at all, Michael, it would be nice if you were.
Sort of.
If you go back into your district. Hi, it's Michael. Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Michael.
Ben
Mankiewicz, go ahead.
No, don't do that.
Sorry.
Come on.
That was too low.
If you go back into your district and you say, I voted against something because it wasn't good enough for you, you're going to get that person's vote. If you go back in there and said, well, I had to do it, and they're saying, but it's still Obamacare, well, screw you. You know, I think it's an easy no vote if you have a coalition, and there seem to be lots of little coalitions that are going to vote with the Democrats against this bill. And that's, you know, if there's no congressional accomplishment, it's those Republican congressmen that don't care about no accomplishment. They care about protecting more than they care about creating, as we've seen.
Right. Okay. So final question, Michael. I think, you know, we might be on sort of different sides of this, but I do think that, you know, my concerns about the Democrats remain ever sort of eternal. And part of that is ideological, being on the left, thinking you need a much more aggressive and unambiguous message about things like income inequality, and also operational, which is like, can these people, regardless of where we stand on the same points politically, can they get a little bit better at politics? But do you think that I guess I want to see if you're going to offer a more optimistic perspective than I still have, which is that if they win, it will be by default because they're still not getting it together strategically. Or do you think that they're, you know, as a final thought, do you think they're coalescing a little bit more effectively now? What do you think the fallout of the DNC race is? I mean, what's the kind of state of play of of Democrats?
Listen, I should say I really like Tom Perez. So I know that probably differs with maybe with you, maybe with the majority.
I don't dislike Tom Perez. I mean, I think a lot of people dislike. I preferred Ellison, and I think that there was a symbolism to that race that mattered and was problematic. But I mean, you know, as a process, Tom Perez being the establishment guy indicates to some degree that the establishment is saying, okay, we need to get a bit more liberal here. Because he is on that progressive side of that spectrum.
That's exactly right. And there's nobody with a more pristine record who has had this job on a pristine record on civil rights and labor and getting the natural coalitions of Democrats together than Tom Perez right now. Keith Ellison is great. A lot of these people, I learned about this guy, Pete Buttigieg, right? Mm-hmm. He's great. He seems like a comer and a really interesting guy. So this election that no one would have ever paid attention to, right? Nobody ever paid attention to these things like they do now. Debbie Wasserman Schultz changed the focus of the chairmanship of the DNC and in a way that people are paying attention to. And now it became a real race. But these are all good people, you know, and on balance. And the whole purity test thing is, I think, the thing that will kill Democrats again and again is this whole issue of purity. And listen, I'm happy to have people disagree with me because I disagree with them. I think the Democrats, if they get what they want, whether by default and by the fact that this is an incompetent president and this is a flustering House of Representatives, I think that's okay too. But I think they're getting their act together. I also don't think you're going to see, you know, I think the way the Democrats who are there govern is different than the way the Republicans do. And if you start asking them to march in lockstep like Republicans, you're asking them to be everything you've criticized for so long. And I'm not saying you, Michael Brooks, I'm saying Democrats in general. Oh my God, the Republicans are just both a party of no. Let's all stick together on this person, on this nominee, on this piece of legislation. Democrats disagree with each other, and that's all right. I disagree with Democrats. I'm fine with it. But it makes it more difficult to govern.
Yeah, and, I mean, that's really the bottom line, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's problematic. I mean, that's you know, a lump you got to live with. But I think that for sure that Donald Trump will allow them to look at their party in a different way now. And like you alluded to earlier, the map is not great for Democrats in the Senate next time. So they have to rely on a little bit of default because they're going to be running in places that are typically difficult. And you can say, oh, just run the most liberal. Yes, that may work. But, you know, losing by 8 and not 6 or 6 and not 8 is not what the Democrats need right now. They need the majorities. And in my opinion, I mean, it's all about the justices. It's all about the judiciary. And the Democrats fighting to get there, however they can get there, to get control of the Judiciary Committee.
Well, Michael, this will be the first of many. We got a lot of stuff, obviously, that we need to keep talking about. I mean, my only final thought is I agree with you to an extent, though I think that as far as winning in more competitive places, like, I don't think that economic populism and aggressiveness on those issues is the area, like, that is the most persuadable area. I mean, it's probably,
I agree with you. Yeah. I don't disagree. I'm talking about the candidates themselves very often.
Gotcha.
But a 1,000%. Yeah. No. I totally agree. I think that's the message of the Democrats. And that's what I think, by the way, is encouraging about Tom Perez, because as Labor Secretary, as part of the Justice Department and the Civil Rights Division, I think all these issues are the types of issues that he dealt with. And now that he has Keith Ellison with him, and they seem like, you know, they seem like such a good team, like they're getting along so well. Mm-hmm. You have all of these sensibilities in one place right now, I think that's a great place for the Democrats to be. And you have one Latino and one African-American, and you have a Muslim, and you have a good mix of people. I think the party's going in the right direction. But, I think everybody's going to be in a hurry, and they're going to want results right away. I think in order for things to change, Republicans in the Senate are going to have to change, and you'll get a handful of those in about, I keep saying, 9 to 15 months. That's when it's going to start.
We'll see. The hope springs eternal. I also think Tom Perez, he had a specific emphasis on voting rights in the campaign, and that was the only area I did prefer Allison, but that was the only area the way Perez articulated it, because that's the voting rights. Is the sort of still a preeminent civil rights issue, and it's also essential for any hope of basically Democratic Party wins in the future. So he was right about that, and that's important. Michael Shore of the Young Turks, formerly of Al Jazeera, and in the future of many things and many future conversations with me. I appreciate your time, man.
I love it. I love it. I had a great time. This is the best that there is. So keep doing it.
Appreciate it, man. Thanks so much. Take care.
I'll talk to you later. All right, yeah, bye-bye.
Okay, everybody, we're going to go to the fun half. The IMs are on. Get to the phones in a second. Fresh Dope Boys dropped today. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. Write the Majority Report in iTunes. Review of justcoffee.coop, Fairtrade, tea, coffee, or chocolate. We've got your calls. We've got your IMs and a bunch more, a bunch of sound, a lot to get to in the fun half. For everybody that's leaving us, see you tomorrow. For everyone else, see you on the fun half. Yeah.